Welcome to the Calder Farmstead, your place for news, analysis, and shenanigans from the American Hockey League.
Faceoff blocked by the Condors. Jones top of the point, fence into the slot. A shot and done!
Point long drive, Jake Kamenik, what a stop by Matisse with the left pad! Oh, there was a scramble in front of the net, denied was Matt Schechter by a miraculous piece of net finding by Matisse Kamenik.
D-Lander from the red line sends it in, Hofer in the best net, he stops it, Hofer looking, Hofer firing toward the empty net, he scores! Are you kidding me?
Now, with 9 minutes gone in overtime, the Bears breaking out. Right side with Fair. Brooks Light cutting to the net. Fair, let's go! Let's go! Let's go! It's
over! Hello, hello, hello from Tampere, Finland.
And Chicago, Illinois.
Welcome to the Calder Farmstead Podcast, episode number 140 for Tuesday, May 23rd, 2023. If you were hoping for a podcast featuring auction strategies for cattle bidding, we are not going to be much help. This is an American Hockey League podcast. My name is Sean O'Brien from StatsTrack and the AHL's only league-wide analytics guy.
And I'm Sarah Avampato from Full Press Hockey and SB Nation's Kane's Country.
As always, we thank you for tuning in with us. And if you're new to hearing Sarah and I talk about hockey, we're going to recap the third round in the Eastern Conference quickly. Then we're going to preview the Eastern Conference Finals of the AHL's 2023 Calder Cup Playoffs. We both watch a lot of AHL games. We're going to talk about what we see when we watch the film, as well as use some advanced stats to help us break that down. If that's new to you, you may want to head over to our YouTube channel or podcast feed, wherever you're listening to us from, and check out Episode 0. It's all the way down at the bottom, but it's there. It's a short primer on some of the stats we're going to be talking about, as well as how we view what's important on the ice. So if you're new to some of the more advanced hockey stats terms like PDO or the point shares model, or newer hockey terms like controlled zone entries or Royal Road, go check that out so you better be able to pick up what we're putting down. I promise it's not that nerdy or technical. It's only 20 minutes, and let's be honest, you wasted 20 minutes taking Nashville sports talk radio hosts seriously. Next time, watch the AHL instead. You'll never get that time back, so next time, why not spend a little more time with us talking hockey? All right, Sarah, once again, we have some league-wide news, but we're going to skip right over it. This is a recap and preview. We will get to, you know, coaches that got hired and fired. We're going to talk about one of them here, but the rest of them we're going to, you know, punt to the off season, or at least to a different time. But right now, let's get right into it. Let's start with a recap of the phone booth knife fight division, the Atlantic, Hershey and Hartford. Sarah, what happened here?
Well, we only had three games of the knife fight here because Hershey swept the series in three games, including one win on the road. So in the first game, Hershey completed the comeback in game one after trailing 2-0 heading into the third period. They got a good break when goaltender Rich crossed his body to try and make a glove save and just totally missed. The Bears got another good break, but the goal pulled when a shot from the point hit Connor McMichael in the upper body and then deflected in to tie the game at two. And then, of course, sealed the comeback off of a turnover in transition that Henrik Borgstrom sniped in on a two-on-one. Game number two, they dominated that as well, as the Wolfpack took just bad penalties that gave Hershey a lot of momentum. They took an early lead on the power play thanks to Joe Snively undressing two Wolfpack penalty killers and then dished to Mason Morelli, who sniped one past Garand. Hartford, of course, battled back in that game. Will Cooley, we'll talk about him in a second, scored off of a nice pass from Ryan Carpenter, who fought off two Bears penalty killers behind the net to make that pass. The Bears then just took over the game. Beck Melinston, Mike Vecchione, Hendrix Lapierre all scored to give the Bears a 4-1 lead. Adam Clendenning bombed one through a layered screen that Hunter Shepard basically never saw. That made it 4-2, but that is basically all the comeback that Hartford could muster in that game. In the decisive game three, Hartford came out swinging, but didn't get the job done, obviously. Ryan Carpenter did a good job playing through contact behind the net to find Turner Elson streaking to the slot, made it 1-0 Hartford. Near the end of the first, Hershey tied it then on a delayed penalty call that saw Anton Blyde fail to cover his assignment, Vinny Iorio, that's a lot of vowels, in the neutral zone. He races in, beats Louis Domingue to make it 1-1 near the end of the second. Hartford then just a lazy effort in the defensive zone. Wyatt Kalanick gives the puck away behind the net, 4-on-4. And basically all four Wolfpack skaters get caught puck watching. Vecchione finds Lucas Johansson across the Royal Road for a goal, made it 2-1. Domingue made a bad mistake then, routine shot. He kicks the rebound out on a low danger shot right to Garrett Pilon for a tap-in. The Bears survived the game 3 onslaught by Hartford and swept the series. So the Bears advanced. What did we miss in this series? Well, Hershey didn't really make the life miserable for either of the goaltenders for Hartford. Yeah, they scored more goals in 3 games than Providence and Springfield did in 6 games combined. And yeah, they were mostly high danger chances, but neither goalie really looked like they had a ridiculously difficult workload. Not a lot of screens or plays, stuff like that. We also missed the whole power play excitement. Power plays mattered here. It wasn't a key point on either side, but the implication was that neither side had a power play worth caring about, as they were unlikely to do anything. I don't necessarily like the setup or look of either team's power plays, but they did find success here. And while here on the show, we do emphasize process over results, you also can't just throw results out the window because they don't fit the analysis. So we're going to take the L on that one as well. And Hartford's defense was just not up to the task of Hershey's forecheck here. Kalanick, Hillman, Hajek, somewhat Brandon Scanlon, just not good in transition. They made a lot of errors that cost Hartford possessions, momentum, and most importantly, goals against. So that's what we didn't get. Sean, what did we get right in this series?
Well, Will Cooley didn't magically appear in the series. He did finally get on the score sheet, 1 goal, 1 assist, but not the type of performance you expect from a player who led the team in shots, was second overall in points for the Wolfpack in the regular season. I believe he led the team in goals. Like, just, he still needed to do more. Yes, he got off the milk carton, but was still nowhere near the impact player that he needed to be. And I think in the balance of things, that's a W for us. We said he needed to. He wasn't. Hartford lost. Hartford was also not the more physical team in this over the course of this series. Hershey's fourth line was the most physical team in this series, followed by maybe a tie between like Hartford and Hershey. But they did not do a good job of bringing the physicality to the Bears, and that showed. That was a key for them that they needed to do to be victorious in the series. They didn't, and they weren't. But we were also very much right on our X factor. The story of the series was Hartford's forecheck versus Hershey's breakout. And you saw Todd Nelson and his staff outduel Chris Knobloch and his staff. Hershey did an excellent job of keeping Hartford from unleashing that forecheck. They challenged dump-ins at the red line, and they got to pucks before they got to the back wall. Hershey must have stopped 10 dump-in attempts in game one, either by breaking up the play with a good stick or getting bodies along the boards to stop rim arounds. I've never seen a team use the strategy of don't let them dump the puck in. But Hershey did a very good job of preventing Hartford from getting those pucks in deep and being able to just send F1 flying at the puck carrier. Hershey also did a good job building safety valves into their breakouts that were new. This was not something they did a lot during the regular season. They would pretty much go north-south and not do like mid-breakout regroups, but they did that a lot in front of in the face of Hartford's pressure, and that was new. They would either have quick regroups where they would kind of circle back and go again, or they would make what are called hinge plays, where basically if you're the puck carrier and you're starting to get pushed to the outside and you're feeling the pressure, you make a pass backward, and that player is basically able to put it up to the other side of the boards. So kind of like how a door hinge, when it opens, it makes this kind of V shape. So you put it back and that guy puts it over to the other side. That breaks your forecheck. Hinges on doors, you know, open the door. Hinge plays on forechecks, open the breakout. And that's exactly what Hershey used them for and did a great job. I feel like neutralizing what was Hartford's biggest weapon coming in, and that was that 1-2-2 forecheck that was relentless against Providence and against Springfield, and Hershey shut it down with well-coached adjustments. All right, Sarah, do you have any final thoughts on the series here? Because I have one or two.
My thought is that I was wrong on the outcome. I blew it.
I mean, I picked Hartford too, because I definitely thought that forecheck would be a lot more disruptive. Credit to Hershey. Todd Nelson out-coached Chris Knobloch in that aspect. But for my final thoughts on the series here, like, Hartford had chances to score and win these games. Like, yeah, Hershey swept the series, but like, I don't think it was as one-sided an ass-beating as some people are making it out to be. I think there were a lot of instances in which Hartford just failed to execute or misplayed a number of key plays where, like, a little bit of being able to settle the puck down or a little bit better timing. And this is a very different series, I think. I think back to the misplay behind the net by Hunter Shepard in game one, where, I mean, I don't remember who it was for Hartford, but missed a basically wide open net. That would have been 2-0 in the first period, Hartford. And in a game that ended 3-2 in overtime, that extra goal, you know, seems like it would have mattered. There were also just a number of times in all three games where backdoor plays for Hartford just saw the pass get through the defense, past, you know, through the maze of sticks, Hunter Shepard's like sprawling out. And the guy at the back door just either couldn't corral the pass, it hops over his stick, or he has to dust it off with some stick handling to get control, or he just whiffs. Like, there were a number of plays like that where Hartford could have had a tap-in goal, and they just couldn't complete the easy part of it of just putting the pass into the net. Like, most of the time, it's the pass that doesn't get there. But there were a number of times those passes got through, and they just couldn't get a stick on it, or couldn't settle the puck down, or just hopped over them. And that was maddening to watch as, you know, someone who picked the Wolfpack and likes to be right. But the other thing I have is Chris Knobloch got outcoached in this series. Todd Nelson, as we just talked about, made the adjustments to their breakout, made adjustments in their end zone offense to attack Hartford. They did a great job of getting Hartford to collapse down low, then putting the puck up high, which created time and space for them to reset. He also benched Adam Clendenning and started Louis Domingue, and those were choices. Like, yeah, I understand. Clendenning was not great in game two, but he's much better than guys like Blake Hillman and would have been an asset in this game, regardless of how bad he played in game two. Like, he was not your seventh most talented defenseman on that roster, and putting him in the press box for that game, not a good choice. I didn't mind starting Louis Domingue, but starting Louis Domingue in a, like, win or go home kind of game, that's a choice. Like, if you start Louis Domingue, you start him in game two, where, you know, if he loses, he at least has a chance to get fresh, get pucked. Like, you can't simulate game conditions, especially for a goaltender, in practice, no matter how hard you try. And Domingue hadn't played in what, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and you're putting him in basically cold in a do or die game. Like, that's a choice. I understand that Caran did not play well in the first two games in Hershey, but I have to wonder if Domingue being cold, like, coming in cold turkey, contributed to that. Like, I would have liked to see if you were going to make that switch, you do it in game two, which, yeah, I feel like was deserved. Caran did not play well in game one. The first goal Hershey scored was off a clear shot from the point, and he tried to, like, go cross body glove save to the point where, like, even Hershey's broadcast was like, yeah, that was stupid. Like, no discredit to Zach Fish, but if he's chirping your goalie for making a bad save selection, you have done screwed up.
Yeah.
The other thing too about that is, on top of that, Knobloch's name was mentioned in contention for the Rangers job. And that's just eye-opening to me. Like, in four seasons in Hartford, he's 112 and 118. That's a losing record. He also had this team in a bad spot until the Rangers intervened at the trade deadline. And that's not a good look for you as the coach. Like, and yes, the Rangers have 100% dealt him crappy hands in terms of roster and their desire to yank important players at key times just to sit them in the MSG press box. But I find it unfathomable that a coach who's never really shown the ability to adapt and overcome in these moments at the AHL level is getting consideration for a promotion when a fair number of his peers actually have shown that ability. His development record also isn't great. It's not terrible, but it's not great. And at the end of the day, I don't think Knobloch's a bad coach, but I just I don't see a lot of evidence that he's a very good one, and certainly not one that should be getting NHL looks based on like a late season run. Like, you know, 15 games of good coaching or good fortune don't outweigh the 200 plus that came before them. I'm sorry. Like, he should stick in Hartford for another year, but I feel like if he didn't go on this playoff run, his job in Hartford was going to be in jeopardy. And then 20 games later, it's like, he may be the Rangers guy. What? All right. I think that's a good place to leave it. Sarah, let's move on and talk about Canada versus America, the Marlies versus the Rochester Americans. Sarah, what happened here?
Well, I've now gone 0-2 in the Eastern Conference because Rochester swept this series in three games, including two wins on the road in Toronto. Game one, Toronto scored first, but Rochester responded with four straight goals spanning from the middle of the first period through the beginning of the third period. Rochester in this game had two power play goals and one shorthanded goals. Toronto, meanwhile, could not capitalize on any of their four power plays in this game. Rochester was 2 out of 3 in this game. Despite scoring first, Toronto had a pretty slow start. They just had four shots on goal in the first period. By the time they really started to gain momentum in the third period, the game was already out of hand. It was too late for them to do anything. Game two featured just a wildly out of control second period. Four straight goals from Rochester in that period, as well as two from Toronto. Shots in the second period were 20-14 in favor of Toronto. Toronto had 23 shots total in game one. So just bonkers. Rochester in that game was 2 out of 5 on the power play, and Toronto was 4 out of 6. So again, just bonanza. Game three again featured Rochester scoring in bunches. That was really the theme of this whole series. Rochester scored three straight in the first period within about a 7-minute span. The rest of the game was much more back and forth in terms of scoring, but Rochester never surrendered the lead after they took it. Rochester in this game was 3 out of 3 on the power play, and Toronto was 1 out of 2. What did we miss? We didn't listen to the model. Both of us ignored it. The model was pretty heavily favored towards Rochester. It gave them a 60.6% chance of winning. We both picked Toronto off of their resiliency this season and expected impact from players being returned from the NHL, and in my case, just pure vibes. But Rochester ultimately was the better team in this series. Also, Eric Sjogren did not continue to perform the way he did in the previous round. Game one, he stopped 16 out of 20. Game two, stopped 15 of 19 and then was pulled after allowing the fourth goal. Keith Petruzzelli came in and wasn't much better, stopped 9 of 11. Game three, Joseph Wall started. That didn't really help the Marlies either. That was an 8-4 loss for the Marlies. Rochester, I think, was going to dominate that game no matter who you put in net. And instead, Joseph Wall got the indignity of being eliminated from the playoffs twice within a span of a very few days. As the saying goes, your goaltender needs to be your best penalty killer. Sjogren wasn't it, but neither was any of the other goaltenders who played or the rest of the Marlies' penalty kill. It was just bad all around. Also, we said that Michael Mersch needed to lead by example. He only had a goal and an assist in this series. That is not nothing, but he had 7 points in the previous series against Syracuse. So we're going to take the L here on that suggestion. That's what we missed. What did we get right on this series?
Biggest one we got right here was discipline is the X factor. You mentioned how well the power play worked. Neither team really stayed particularly disciplined, and both teams got burned on the power play. Rochester was 7-for-11 on the power play, plus one shorthanded goal. Toronto 5-for-12, 4-for-12 net on the power play. This series could have looked much different had just Toronto been even a little bit more effective on the PK, or just taken a fewer number of penalties, or both. Game one at even strength, Toronto actually won the, like, Toronto outscored Rochester at even strength 3-1. Actual score 4-3 Rochester. Game two at even strength, 4-0 Rochester. Actual score 7-4. Game three at even strength, 4-3 Rochester. Actual score 8-4. Like, the fact that we could have been going to a fourth game for Toronto should they not have like been abysmal on the penalty kill, that's something. And also, like we talked about the whole time, Rochester needs power plays to win. They have not won a game in the postseason without a power play goal. One of the things we got right was the hostile Blue Cross arena. One game was played in Rochester, but wow, did they pack that building. Listed attendance was 10,662 for game three. Toronto's home game one was, I think, a little under 4,000. Game two is around 6,200, which is very much a generous accounting of those attendance numbers and clearly reflects tickets sold and not actual Canadian butts and seats, because looking at the like pulled back view that Toronto does during TV timeouts when everyone just like takes a minute, you know, use the bathroom, grabs a candy bar, and like they just have that kind of like mile high view from the corner, you could see there was nobody there, which I don't understand. Like a couple of years ago when they were, you know, called when they went to the Calder Cup and won, like that place was electric every night. And yeah, I understand this team and that team are not the same team, but like they won the division this year and still won a round in the playoffs. Like, did no one have faith, or were they all just too like melancholy after the Leafs? Like, you would have thought there would have at least they'd at least be able to get, you know, somebody, but like how? And I looked it up too. This season they averaged 1,500 fans fewer per game than in 18-19. 1,500 fewer. That's a lot. I don't know what's going on with the Marlies faithful, but it's not a good look for the center of the hockey universe right now. Other things we did not get right, or that we did get right. The Marlies did not continue to play with defensive structure that was good. They did basically the opposite of that. That was one of their keys to the series. That was how they overcame problems in Utica, was they cleaned up defensive structure, or they cleaned up their defensive play and played with better structure. They did the opposite of that, just an alarming number of goals against where they were caught puck watching or out of position or both. And that was a key to the series that they needed to do. They did do it, and they lost very much because of it. The Marlies also didn't get contributions from up and down the lineup like they had in previous series and throughout most of the season. They got one goal from their bottom six the entire series. That ain't getting it done. We also talked about Rochester playing boat race hockey, if they were getting the better of it or not playing. And they played, and they got the better of it. They played north-south hockey. They weren't afraid to trade chances. They very much got the better of those chances. Their transition game was high caliber in a series that was played basically with a wide open neutral zone for the most part. That's all the stuff that we got right. Sarah, any closing thoughts on the series here?
Yeah, I think the attendance one, the fan base one, is really interesting to me. I was actually in Toronto and went to a game that year that they won the Calder Cup. And yeah, that arena was packed. It was loud. It was hard for the other team, you know, the whole hard to play against thing. And to see how quickly things change and to see that arena, like, not even pretending to be full for these games. Yeah, sure, the series wasn't going their way, but it's just interesting to see how much that shifted. And then in comparison with that home game in Rochester, where it was just like, you could have mistaken it for an NHL game. Like, that is how packed it was. That is how amped up that crowd was. And, you know, you can't quantify that. There's no stat that takes into account, you know, home arena wackiness. But you hear players talk all the time about how it feels to play in front of a crowd that is that amped up. And you know that had to really help propel them to that, you know, just this whole series was weird, but like that game three win, it was not in question at any point in time that Rochester was going to win.
No. And I think it's weird too, because like you see, like Belleville has no crowds ever, but like Abbotsford had great playoff atmosphere, but Calgary gets nobody, but Laval gets everybody.
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand. Like, you would have just the blanket, like, oh, it's a professional hockey team, Canadians will show up. No. Not all of them. Like, the fact that Abbotsford and Laval are both, you know, suburbs of their NHL market, as are Belleville. And I mean, Toronto's how far away from the Air Canada Center, which is all I will ever refer to it as. I don't even know what the real name is. But it's like, they're all right in the back door, right on the back door of their NHL club. And the disparity in their draw is unbelievable. Yeah. Like, I don't understand why it's such a big deal. And I understand Belleville is not as big a city, but like, it's not that small. And the arena is not that big. Like, why is this such a problem? I think we should talk here a little bit about Greg Moore and his staff getting fired. I've started to at least come around a little bit on this. Like, I think what Moore and his staff did this year was impressive, given the fact that they had the largest number of starting roster games lost, which is a stat that we tracked that was basically like, all right, who was on your roster opening weekend of the AHL season? Because if they were on your roster opening weekend of AHL season, it's a reasonable thought that, like, you expected them to be a part of your team this year. And all of the games those players miss matters. Like, it's not a perfect one-to-one with injuries and call-ups and stuff like that, but it's a at least decent approximate. They led the league with 629 man games lost from the starting roster, from the opening weekend roster. Second place was Laval with 571, just to give you an idea of how big a gap there was between Toronto and everyone else. And they won the division. They had a 9-game winning streak. They had two top 10 special teams units in the AHL this year. Like, that's not nothing. And yeah, Greg Moore's like developmental record isn't spectacular, but it's not terrible. It's not like he's bricked multiple first round picks. And a lot of the players he's had to work with are projects. Like, second to Arachintsev has been a project. And he's made good progress. But like, at the same point too, last year was not good under Greg Moore. And yeah, he finished out 19-20 and then played the bubble year. And you can call those mulliganable mulliganable, where it's like, that's hard to, he came in halfway through the season, then got COVID bubble year. That was not a real year. Like, how much do you hold that against him? But at the end of the day, it's like, I thought he should have gotten one more year, but his contract was up, and like, a 1-year extension is not a thing that happens in coaching contract. So it was either, you know, clean house or try and figure out a way to be comfortable with 2 or 3 more years on his contract. And given what Toronto did with the rest of their staff the other day, this seemed like a pretty natural move. I don't think that they were necessarily connected. But if you're going to look to start to move on to new leadership, this seems like a reasonable piece of business. Like, I still think Greg Moore is a decent coach. I don't think he's a great coach. I think what he did this year was pretty impressive, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's, you know, what I expect from him every year. But I think he should be at least getting calls about other open jobs in the AHL, maybe not as a head coach, but somewhere on the staff. But interesting to see him get fired after what was his most successful year, winning a playoff round. Like, I know that probably doesn't matter a bunch to the Leafs front office, but at the same point, that is a weird look for you firing your coach when there are so many other much more deserving coaches to be fired that haven't accomplished half of that. Anyway, I think that's a good place to leave it. We're going to take a break here. After the break, we will get to the previews for the Eastern Conference Finals matchup. If you're just here for a series recap, thank you for stopping by. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you're listening to us from, so you get episodes in a timely fashion. Also, check us out on social media. We have fun there. We post some memes. We have a good time. Links to our social media and more can be found at our Linktree page at linktr.ee/TheCalderFarmstead. We're going to run some ads, pay some bills. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back from break. I hope you enjoyed whatever ads you definitely didn't fast forward through. Let's get down to brass tacks here. We have an Eastern Conference final to preview. The Hershey Bears versus the Rochester Americans. Game one is today, Tuesday, May 23rd at 7 p.m. Game two, Thursday, May 25th, 7 p.m. at Hershey. Game three, Saturday, May 27th, 7:05 p.m. at Rochester. Game four is Monday, May 29th, 6.05 p.m. at Rochester. Game five, if necessary, Wednesday, May 31st, 7 p.m. at Hershey. Game six, Friday, June 2nd, 7.05 p.m. at Rochester. Game number seven, if necessary, Monday, June 5th, 7 p.m. at the Giant Center in Hershey, Pennsylvania. They are going with the NHL 2-2-1-1-1 schedule here, and I like it. I'm here for it. All right. I will take us here first with the Hershey Bears side of things. Let's talk about how they got here. Their playoff journey to this point was a first-round bye. Then they beat Charlotte in four games in the second round. Then they swept Hartford in the phone booth knife fight finals. If you want to hear our recap of that series, you're going to have to rewind a little bit. We talked about it at the beginning of the show. Hershey's season record was 44-28. That was fourth in the AHL. Their net power play in rank in the regular season was 15.4%. That was 21st in the AHL. In the playoffs, 22.7%, seventh of 23 playoff teams. Their penalty kill was 83.1% in the regular season. That was 18th. In the playoffs, 80%. That is 14th out of 23 playoff teams for net penalty kill. If the Bears win, it's because they either stay out of the penalty box or get a lot better killing penalties. Rochester's power play is deadly in the playoffs. Talk about more about that in detail when we look at their stats. But in short, they're the number two power play out of all the playoff teams and the number one out of the remaining teams in the playoffs. Meanwhile, of the remaining teams, Hershey's PK is next to last. Only worst is Rochester. While no one on the Bears is taking an overwhelming amount of penalties, the most is six penalty minutes for Iorio, Malenstein, and McElrath. They can't take any chances against what is essentially the best power play in the postseason. So no post-whistle shenanigans, no offensive zone penalties, no careless stick infractions, no one-handing the stick trying to, like, tap the guy. Like, do not do that. If you're going to take a penalty here, it needs to be one that you were pretty sure prevented a goal. Not like a, oh, I didn't like this guy, so into the net you go. Nope. No. Rochester also hasn't won a single game in the postseason when they failed to score in the power play. They were a negative goal differential team, 5-on-5 in the regular season, and of their 34 goals in the postseason, only 18 are 5-on-5. Their goal differential per game, 5-on-5 in the playoffs, is plus 0.62. Hershey is plus 0.185 per game in the playoffs, 5-on-5. Rochester's power play is a dynamic one that's always looking east-west across Royal Road for one-timers and wants to set up backdoor tap-in plays. Hershey is going to need its penalty killers to have their heads on swivels, looking over their shoulder, and making sure they identify threats behind them and are in passing lanes across Royal Road and to the back door. Rochester is going to test you there. Toronto got caught puck-watching a ton on the penalty kill, and look at all the good that that did them. Hershey is also going to need to find the right balance of pressure as well. Toronto got caught over-pursuing on the penalty kill and gave up power play goals that way. But you can't just let us, team with as much power play talent as Rochester, you know, bring the attack to you. You can't just sit and try and lock down the slot and let them wander outside. That also won't work. Both Syracuse and Toronto tried that, and, well, here we are. Hershey is going to have to work hard on practice. At when to apply pressure, when to try and force turnovers, and when to be more conservative and yield some time and space to the outside to better protect the slot and Royal Road. If they can keep the Amerks power play off the board, or better yet, off the ice, the Bears are going to the Calder Cup Finals. If the Bears win this series, it's because they continue to clog up the neutral zone and force the Amerks to play dump and chase. The other aspect of Rochester's game that powers them to victories is their ability to generate offense off the rush. Against Toronto, they scored one goal more than 8 seconds from a zone entry while 5-on-5. And it was Jeremy Davies right after the power play expired in game one. So not even a real goal off the cycle, so to speak. Hershey is going to have to make sure that they lock up the neutral zone. I'd recommend they shift to a more conservative forecheck than they're currently using, whether that's a more dialed back 1-2-2 than they currently use, or a 1-1-3 like the Islanders, Lightning, or Maple Leafs use, or a 1-3-1 like the Capitals did in the 2022 playoffs against Florida. Either way, they need to clog up the neutral zone and make sure they don't get forwards caught behind the puck in transition. Rochester has picked apart teams throughout the regular season and playoffs with north-south boat race hockey. They aren't afraid to trade chances either, as they seem to believe they're going to get the better of them. And so far, they've been right. But if Hershey lets them build speed and fly through the neutral zone on the way to a controlled zone entry, the Bears' blue line does not have the foot speed to contain them, and Hershey will lose this series. Lastly, the Bears will win this series if they bring the atmosphere. Hershey is supposed to be the crown jewel of fan bases of the AHL. They're supposed to be the biggest, loudest, most loyal, and most knowledgeable fans in the AHL. And while that's entirely debatable, one thing is for sure. So far, they've been outdone in arena atmosphere. The Blue Cross Arena in Rochester has been nothing short of electric. They packed the building against Toronto. They are currently averaging more than 1,500 fans than Hershey per game. 1,500 more Rochester Americans fans in their building than Bears fans in Giant Center. And it's impossible to say that it hasn't made a difference. The Amherst fans traveled too. They went to Syracuse in a do-or-die Game 5 and out-cheered them in their own building. So why is Giant Center chalking in at a 7 out of 10 on the hype scale in these playoffs? I don't know why, but are you really about to let the Amherst fans out-hustle you, out-cheer you, Hershey? The Amherst Mafia claims to be the best fans in the AHL, and if they outsell you again in this round, they're right, point blank. If you want a shot at banner number 12, you need to show up en masse, fill every seat, and be loud, because the Amherst certainly will. And if you don't bring that atmosphere, you're not going to see banner number 12 get dropped in October. Sarah, take the other side. Tell me about the Amherst.
All right, so how did they get here? Their playoff journey so far, they had a first-round bye. The second round, they beat Syracuse in 5 games. And then, as we just discussed, they swept Toronto in the North Division Finals. In the regular season, they were 36-36, good for 15th in the AHL. Their net power play was 17.2% in the regular season, good for 13th in the league. In the playoffs, it is a big number. It's 41.4%. That's a big jump. That is second out of 23 playoff teams in the playoffs. Net penalty kill is 84.4% in the regular season, 12th in the league. In the playoffs, it is 75%, 16th out of 23 playoff teams. So if the Rochester Americans win this series, it's going to be because they win shifts in the bottom six. Rochester has the horses in their top six to at least play to a draw with Hershey and their top six. If they can win shifts there, that is great, but the top six playing to a draw is more than fine. Where Rochester needs their lineup to win is in the bottom six, or their bottom five, as it were, because they have been playing 11-7. For some secret reason. Hershey gets a lot out of the bottom of their lineup. Their third line is Alexei Protas, Hendrix LaPierre, Sam Annis. That is a guy who played 58 NHL games this season. It's a first-round draft pick that scored 15 goals in the AHL and a former AHL league leading scorer. They have 7 goals as a line in the postseason so far. 6 of those are at 5-on-5. That is the third line for Hershey. They are that deep. Hershey's fourth line is Beck Malenstein, Riley Sutter, and Mason Morelli. It's a line that gets on the scoreboard that more often, a little more often than you would expect from them. They've got 4 goals, 5-on-5 in the playoffs. But more importantly, most importantly, they win shifts and they create momentum for Hershey. They are the Bears' crash and bang line, and they very much excel in that role of forechecking hard, punishing puck carriers, creating momentum, and then getting the heck off the ice. They are basically the Attitude Era, Stone Cold, Steve Austin of AHL fourth lines. Arrive, raise hell, leave. More so because despite all the physicality they bring, they've also combined for 7 minor penalties in 7 games. For a crash and a bang, a blunt instrument line that is about as good a result
as you can hope. And that has worked tremendously for the Bears. It helped them flip the script and out-forecheck a Wolfpack team that was known for its forechecking prowess in the playoffs. Rochester's third line, Kozak, Malone, and Rosean. That is a solid third line, but they are going to have to step up, find a way to win shifts, and create momentum if they're going to outmatch that third line from Hershey. Rochester doesn't have a true fourth line. Again, they go 11-7. Why not? Warren and Olszewski are going to need to bring the ice bags hold serve against Hershey's stone cold line. If Rochester can win shifts in the bottom six, they're going to the Calder Cup finals. And if they win, it's because they have decided to bring the wood. So in college football, there is a phrase that is printed in basically every defensive meeting room in the country: bring the wood. It is meant to remind players that every play they need to be prepared to go make plays, tackle with force. Its origins are a little hard to pin down, but it's basically ubiquitous as a football motivational cliche. Regardless of where it came from, whatever, it needs to be Rochester's mindset here in this series. Hartford was supposed to be the more physical team in the phone booth knife fight division finals. They weren't. Some of that was due to the aforementioned stone cold line. Some of it was just not being able to lay hits and finish checks. When Hartford was able to lay the body, though, it was effective. They forced turnovers. They won board battles in those moments. Rochester needs to see that success and dial it up to 11. And they already have a set of guys who do that already. They've got Michael Mersch, Brett Murray, Matt Barkowski, Brendan Warren, but that is not enough. This needs to be a full team effort to grind down and outlast a supremely talented and very deep Hershey team. Guys who don't normally get involved in the physicality are going to need to step it up. That means guys like Linus Weisbach, Lucas Rousek, Lawrence Pilat, Yuri Kulik, they all need to be on board here and bring the wood. So if Rochester can be the more physical team, if they can bring the wood, they are going to the Calder Cup finals. That's what Rochester needs to do to win. Before we make our predictions, what is our X factor for this series?
So our X factor for this series is Malcolm Subban. Subban has been good enough to get the job done in the playoffs for Rochester, but he hasn't been fantastic. He's made big saves, but he's also let in some goals that make you go, 306 goals against average, 910 save percentage. Of the four remaining goalies, he's third in save percentage, fourth in GAA. Facing an average of 34.6 shots per night, 0.172 goals saved above average in the playoffs. So he's a net force for good, but is a 9-10 goalie really what you want to be, you know, carrying you is a very important piece to the Calder Cup finals. Much of Rochester's success is going to depend on whether or not Subban can elevate his game, particularly if he has to make up for any shortcomings of the team around him. We call those shortcomings in this case the penalty kill. Rochester is going to need Subban to steal a game, but can he? Can he make that one last save when needed? Above all else, Hunter Shepherd across the ice from him has shown that he can pull one more save out of the hat if necessary. Subban is going to have to be able to match that. They came away with a win against the Marlies, but it was a high scoring affair. Like, Rochester plays a power play first, you know, fast tracked kind of game. And that is, well, the power play penalty kill is not Hershey's strength, but locking it down and playing a low paced, boring style of hockey is what Hershey has done all year. And if that's the case, Rochester is going to have a lot harder time outscoring problems that they have. And that means Malcolm Subban is going to need to step up and perform in those moments. If he doesn't, Rochester's not going to make it. But if he does, Rochester has a very good chance of winning this series. That means his ability to tip the scales is huge in this series. That is why he's our X factor for the Eastern Conference Finals. Sarah, we are at the end of the preview part. We are at the time in which we pick a winner here. Would you like to go first or second?
I'll go first. I'll get mine out of the way. So first up, I was wrong about everything in the previous round. We're gonna, like, for my pride, hope that maybe I do a little better this round. We've talked about this all season long. Goaltending has basically been highly optional for the North Division. That hasn't really changed here in the playoffs. our X factor of Malcolm Subban, like we just talked about, he's been fine for the Americans. He hasn't really needed to be more than just fine yet. I think it's been a long time coming for Hershey to make this deep of a run. I don't know that just fine from Malcolm Subban is going to be enough with this Hershey team that is as deep as they are. So I think that this is Hershey's year. I'm taking the Bears here.
For me, I've said the whole time that whoever won the phone booth knife fight is going to the Calder Cup Finals. I have not respected the North Division pretty much the entire season. We've been giving them grief for their inability to kill penalties, play defense. Like, it's been fun. It's been entertaining hockey to watch. Don't get me wrong. But when they, we've always said when they went head to head in a series against a serious business team like Hershey very much is, whoever won that division, whether it was Utica, Syracuse, Rochester, or Toronto, they were going to fold like an origami crane. My bingo card for 2023 has the Atlantic Division winner sweeping the North Division winner. I don't know if I believe that they sweep, but I think Hershey is the better team here, and I don't think it's all that close. Aaron Ness is likely to return, and if Scarbosa and Nardella can get back into the lineup, that only widens the gap here for Hershey. I'm taking the Bears. I cannot look at both rosters here and say, nope, I'm going to take the scrappy underdog team again, when last time at least they had physicality and goaltending and some battle to them. I don't see that from Rochester, at least not in a way that makes me believe they could take down a team like Hershey here. I'm taking the Bears. And the model is on our side. Hershey is only a 54.7% favorite to win the series. I'm surprised it was that low, but I'm seeing Scarbosa, Nardella, and Ness not currently in the lineup for them. That does change some things. Scarbosa comes back, you're going to see that widen a lot. But all three of us on the side for Hershey. Sarah, we did it. We made it. And in 40-something minutes, too. Like, yeah. I think this choice to split things up was a smart one.
Yeah.
Any closing thoughts before we go home?
I'm excited. I feel like this is when it gets, you know, it gets a lot easier to really hone in and focus in on the series and what's happening. And I don't know that either of these teams are who I would have picked to be here in the Eastern Conference Final on day one of the series, but it's going to be fun. These are two very different teams stylistically, and it's going to be an adventure, and it feels very much like the last goal wins.
These are also two teams who very much have their fan base that believes that their team is the chosen one. So I think that makes it interesting. And Yaz, you're right. The fact that, like, I don't have to put up four screens to watch all of the games now definitely helps us do better analysis, as I'm not as scattered trying to watch the game, as well as, you know, being able to kind of focus in on, you know, what makes each team their own thing. Very, very interesting series here. Like you said, two completely opposite styles. I think it's going to be an interesting one. And if nothing else, it's going to be one that gives us fun environments to watch, because seeing a you know, deciding playoff game played in front of like a half empty lower bowl is not fun. Like, that makes me sad to watch. And it's happened quite a few times in the playoffs already. And I'm very much anticipating it will not even come close to happening here. I want full buildings and marginally drunk fans. That being said, Sarah, I would like to be one of those marginally drunk fans, so please take us out.
All right. That is it for the show today. Thank you so much for watching and or listening. The Calder Farmstead is a part of the Full Press Radio Network. You can listen to this and several other great hockey, sports, and sports entertainment programs all at www.fullpresscoverage.com. Just click the podcast drop-down menu in the top right portion of the website and enjoy.
And if you guys are enjoying the Calder Farmstead, please make sure you subscribe so you get episodes in a timely fashion. Also, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon, please rate and review the podcast. Please, please, please rate and review the podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, like the video and comment what you thought of the episode. Doing so helps others find the show, and your reviews help us improve it. You can also follow the show on social media at Calder Farmstead on Twitter, at The Calder Farmstead on Instagram and Facebook. I will give you a little hint. Our social media content is not the same across all three platforms. So you are missing stuff if you don't have an Instagram account. If that's okay with you, all right. But we have fun memes that only go on Instagram. Big thanks to Adrian Drake, who made our theme music. You can find him on social media at AD_dysfunction. That's AD_dysfunction. So we can make music for you too. Sarah, where can the people find you?
So my name is Sarah Avampato, and you can find me representing Full Press Hockey on Twitter at Right Said Sarah. That's W-R-I-T-E said Sarah with an H. You can check out my writing at Full Press Hockey, where I talk about the Ontario Reign, or at Canes Country, where I talk about the Chicago Wolves. Sean, where can people find you?
I'm Sean O'Brien. You can find me on Twitter at SeanO'Brien81. That's S-E-A-N-O-B-R-I-E-N 81. I'm also on Instagram at SeanO'Brien_81. You can find my stats work, including the money puck graph, the game probabilities, all of the playoff stuff. You can find all of that on my Tableau page at bit.ly/datadumpandchase, all lowercase, all one word. We got it done at a reasonable time here, and by that I mean it is 12:20 here. I'll do it this way. 12:28.
It's totally normal person time.
Considering that last time it was 3 a.m. and if we would have tried to put the Western Conference in here, this would have been, we might as well have just done it live to make it Tuesday morning. So thank you guys all for tuning into the show. For Sarah Avampato, I am Sean O'Brien. Please, please dump and chase responsibly.